Well, then this night is the Book of Ecclesiastes. Of course, tonight isn't enough time to really do the book in any comprehensive way, but I'd like to at least give an overview of some of the main points concerning the writings of Ecclesiastes. There are several points that we could, several headings, topics that we could use, which would be applicable to Ecclesiastes. Let me just try to give an introduction to the book. Essentially, let's first say what the book is about. What is the nature? What is the writing about? The writing of the book concerns human life, and essentially, what Ecclesiastes does is he shows that every lifestyle imaginable is basically fantasy, and since it's fantasy, it's frustrating. Now he uses two terms in the book. One is hevel in Hebrew, which means it means like air, like something which is nothing really. And the other term he uses is ru'us ruach. That means modern terms that would be frustration. So he shows that things are empty, and also that they're frustrating. And what he does is he goes through every single lifestyle and he shows why each lifestyle is frustrating. Amazing is the scope of the book and the lifestyles that he goes through. Covers just about every type of life that a person could lead. I mean, there's a lot of mixtures, but he hits the major ones. And that's really the substance of the book. Many people get depressed when they read Ecclesiastes. It sounds depressing. Well, he does say that the heart of the wise man is in the house of mourning, and the fool is in the house of, is in the house of rejoicing. So Ecclesiastes would say that if you get depressed from the truth, then maybe you're better off with depression. At least you'll be in line with reality. But a person who evades reality must pay the price. I'm just giving you, would be heading one. What is the book about? This is just a general statement. We'll come back to it more. There are other points that perhaps would be more important as a point of departure, a starting point concerning the book of Ecclesiastes. One would be his methodology. What is the methodology that he uses?
Rabbi, yeah. Gary Buchanan said that he would like for you to give an example of those two words that you began with in English in the text so we could see kind of how they were used.
Okay, hold on. Then just give me a second, all
right? Okay, all right. All right, thank you.
Okay, the words in the text. Let's take the very first verse, okay? The second verse, I mean. Ecclesiastes 1, 2, all right? Now, here he says, the first one, that's havel. Now, I don't know what your translation is. It probably is vanity, emptiness. Yeah, vanity is not really a good word. It's not a precise, doesn't carry a precise meaning. The translation is usually tried, the literary style is a greater concern than giving you an accurate meaning of the word. But the word havel, havola, means an emptiness of emptinesses. Says Ecclesiastes, okay? That's the word emptiness. And we'll explain what he means by an emptiness of emptinesses. But there's the word, okay? Now, he constantly repeats that term. Like when he comes to something, he immediately says that this is emptiness. All right? Take a look, 14, all right? And 14, he says, I saw all the things that were done under the sun, and behold, everything is emptiness. That's that word, hevel, again. And the next word is frustration, ru'us ruach. That means life is frustrating. Life is empty, life is frustrating. And he shows, and then he proceeds to go through the various lifestyles, showing that each one leads to nothing more than emptiness and frustration. Okay? If you'd like, I'll give you an example of that. Take a look at 2. All right? Take a look at 2. So, in 2, he states that, he says, and I said in my heart that I will engage in happiness and see good. Which means to say that he's going to enjoy himself, partake of the lifestyle of enjoyment. And then he says, and behold, that too is emptiness. And now he explains why. He says, because play, which is like enjoyment, I said is simply the word over there that he uses is maholo. It's interpreted as meaning something which leads a person to depression, okay? And the next thing he says is, and happiness, I say simcha, meaning partaking, simcha means like a happy, joyous occasion. And joyousness and happiness, I said, what does it do? Okay, now, you always must, the Ecclesiastes, and the same thing is true of all the Torah, demands a certain two things. A person has to have a certain level of intelligence, but a person must also know how to interpret the written word. If you aren't trained in the method of interpretation, your chances are very slim of really uncovering the ideas. Now, let me just take this one, just give you an example. What is he saying here? I mean, you know, a person could just say anything is nothing. What is the proof? Well, what he's saying is as follows. His premise is that it's based upon his psychological understanding of man. And there's another word here which is extremely important, and that is the word in verse 1, verse 3, where he says, what Yisron is the word in Hebrew. How do they translate that? Okay, they say prophet. The word Yisron, the problem is always just translations. The word Yisron comes from the word Yoser, which means more. Okay, more. Meaning to say, what? I'll explain to you why, what exactly it means. But let's just get that idea, something more. What extra, what more is there for man with all the toil that he toils under the sun? What does he mean by this statement? You see, the wise king Solomon is giving us something here in this statement. He's teaching us something. What he's teaching us is that man, the psychological makeup of man, is that a person is always looking for something that is extra, special, more. A person doesn't want to live just an ordinary, drab existence. Not happy with that. Every person wants to feel they're special. They're doing something extra. They're looking, a person is looking for something which makes him feel important, makes his life feel like he's doing something fantastic. Whether the person is the head of a business, whether he's a CEO, whether he's a religious leader, it makes no difference what he's doing. Whatever a person does, he strives for one thing. He strives for that sense of importance, that feeling of being someone that's special, that extra feeling, that good feeling. And that's what Ecclesiastes' understanding of human psychology is, that a person cannot be happy just thinking to himself, what am I? I am basically what does Aristotle say? Man is a rational animal, and I exist, I eat, I sleep, I may think, whatever, and this is my life. A person will not be happy that way. Human psychology is such that man is looking for something extra in life. Okay, that's a premise of his understanding of human psychology. Now, premising that, you see, that's why these two verses, these two opening verses, are very important. When he says everything is empty, and then he says what gain is there, or what extra is there for man? So, what he's trying to show is that man is looking for that something in life that makes him feel important, superior. in a way, not necessarily in a bad way, in a good way, something special about himself, and he's looking for accomplishment. Accomplishment would fit in perfectly with Ecclesiastes' concept of the Yisroel, the word accomplishment. You say, well, what does a person want in life? A person wants to accomplish something, wants to do something. What do you mean do something? Why don't you just, what does an animal do? It eats, sleeps, and it enjoys the instinctual life, and that's it. Can a person just say, look, that's all I am, okay? And I'm just going to enjoy life physically, instinctually, intellectually, that's it. So King Solomon says, no, that's impossible from a psychological standpoint for a human being to do that. And now once he premises that, then he goes to show the various lifestyles that try to achieve that extra, that special kind of sense of satisfaction, that sense of accomplishment that I did something, and he shows every single one fails. Okay. By the way, this idea that a person is looking for something extra in life was also mentioned by the philosopher Bertrand Russell. All right, he says that, and I'm quoting Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell, as you know, was an agnostic. He was not a religious philosopher at all, but a very intelligent person, a brilliant mathematician and physicist. I mean, a philosopher, a historian. He was a man of many, many different talents and superb minds. But he wasn't agnostic. He was not religious. Now, he says as follows. He says, the world has need of a philosophy or a religion which will promote life. All right? He says, but in order to promote life, it is necessary to value something other than mere life. In other words, you can't just say, well, I'm just living. That's it. I live 70 years, eat, sleep, enjoy life. Your life, a person is not with. He says, life devoted only to life is animal, without any real human value, incapable of preserving men permanently from weariness and the feeling that all is vanity. I wouldn't be surprised if he gleaned this from Ecclesiastes. It sounds right out of Ecclesiastes. And he was well read, and I'm sure he read the Bible. He says, if life is to be fully human, it must serve some end which seems in some sense outside human life. Some end which is impersonal and above mankind, such as God, or truth, or beauty. All right? So he says, those who best promote life do not have life for their purpose. They aim what seems like a gradual incarnation, a bringing into our human existence of something eternal, something that appears to the imagination to live in a heaven remote from strife and failure and the devouring jaws of time. This is Ecclesiastes. It's an amazing thing, but that's what he's saying. And Ecclesiastes' theme is based on that. The fact that man is looking for that something special, call it eternal, infinite, whatever it is, but he's trying to link up to something very important. Okay? And therefore, he says, since man has that drive, now the question is, given that drive, and this is his dilemma, that's the nature of man, how does man fulfill that drive? Can he satisfy it or not? Ecclesiastes gives a very devastating answer. He says, no, he can't. And he shows each time why that is the case. And what you have to do is, you have to be able to understand the method of analysis of the biblical text, in order to be able to see how he's telling you that it fails. Okay, let me just take this one case that we mentioned before. All right, now he says here, he says that he tried to engage in enjoyment, happiness, rejoicing. That seems like a wonderful thing to do. What does a person want in life? They try to have parties. A man tries to be happy, tries to enjoy himself. So he says, what's wrong with that? That's where he says in 2:1, he says he's going to engage in it. In 2:2, he shows you what's wrong with it. What's wrong with it? He says two things. It's devastating, and what does it do? What does it do? What does it mean when he says, and to rejoicing, I said, what does it do? What does that mean? You have to think into the words of the man. After all, this is King Solomon, the wisest of men. When he says something, you have to think about it. Now, what is he saying when he says, and to rejoicing, what does it do? What does he mean to say? He's saying very simply, when a person rejoices, after he gets finished rejoicing, he finds he's in depression. Why? Because he thinks to himself, what did I accomplish? What did I do? What did I accomplish? Nothing. So man looks to be happy, tries to rejoice, wants to enjoy life, but he finds when he rejoices, the party has to be over. And when the party's over, he thinks back, what did I accomplish last night? Nothing. And a part of man, an intrinsic part of man, is that need to feel a sense of accomplishment. You see, the playboy kind of life tries to deny that, tries to deny that truth, tries to say, well, I'm just going to have fun, just going to enjoy life. That's the lifestyle of the playboy. But the playboy life can never be satisfying because there's something in man that is looking for this feeling of accomplishment and being something special. You see, more than just an animal. And man looks for it in various fields. He looks for it in business, to become a great businessman, an empire builder. That's going to make him feel he's something very special. Or he may look for it in knowledge. He may look for it in religion. Every area is open for that kind of a pursuit. He may look for it in physics. He may look for it in science and mathematics. Every area basically is open for that kind of a possibility. And this is what came, this is the nature of this. I'm just giving you the essential idea of the book. The essential idea of the book is to show that there is not a single lifestyle that can really satisfy that need in man, which on the surface sounds devastating, and it sounds like there is like human happiness is just a hopeless goal. Don't even try. Okay, we'll get to that later. Is there a solution to the problem? Okay, I'm just telling you the answer. I don't want anybody to get through the press. The answer is there is, but it's very, very difficult, very, very rare. Okay. Now, let me just. Let me just give one more example of a lifestyle that he shows doesn't work. This one's one. The first one I gave was the lifestyle of basically the Hollywood lifestyle, the partying lifestyle. Partying lifestyle leads to depression because the fact that it doesn't satisfy man's inner need for accomplishment. But what about, let's take the religious lifestyle. What is it all about that? What about the monk? The person that tries to escape the world and just cloaks himself with a certain feeling of religiosity, feels very holy, the holy emotion. That certainly is a lifestyle. Okay, that's something that we're all familiar with. The religious man, the man that tries to walk around feeling holy and special. That's his method, by the way, of accomplishing what Ecclesiastes is saying. Except he's trying to do it through the religious sphere. He's really no different in his attempt than a person that's doing it through any other way. When you look at it from a psychological standpoint, okay? Now, take a look. He takes that up in 7:16. All right. There he says, "Do not be too righteous." Okay, and then he says, "Do not be too righteous." I'm jumping to the end of the verse because he says, "Why should you become desolate?" Okay. So there, when he says, "Do not be too righteous," there he's speaking about the righteous lifestyle, where he's saying a person who devotes himself to righteousness, to being a monk. In other words, removing yourself from society and just walking around all day and not eating much and restrictions and keeping away from other people, being alone, and just engaging in religious devotion. He says, if you do that, what happens? You become desolate. Why? What's the reason for desolation? The reason is, again, when you look at human nature, you will see that any person that does that is merely suppressing the other side of his nature. And what happens is that there's a backlash from the other side. The other side, you can't just take a human being and do anything you want with him. That's a mistake that most people make. They feel that they could do anything. Because suddenly they feel that, okay, I'm going to become a religious person now. That's very nice. For an hour. Very nice. But then what happens is, after a while, the other side of their nature, the instinctual side, is starts demanding, making demands on the person, which the person is not satisfying. Then when a person is in a state where the demands are made upon them, their psyche is making demands on them they can't satisfy, they become depressed and desolate. That's what he says about the religious lifestyle. So I'm just giving an example of, you know, just two of them. There are many of them that he has in the book. You have to be able to, you have to be able to seek them out, I mean, to find them, but they are there. So we'll come back to that. That's just, as I said, you know, we have to approach this in a multidimensional way. This is one aspect, all right? The next point I said that we should discuss is his methodology in teaching something. And you'll find that he has an interesting methodology, okay? His methodology, just to give you an example, and you'll have to pardon me, but really, you know, I didn't take time to jot down a lot of these verses, okay? So it took me a second to find it. Let's take, for instance, the case. Let's take just give me one second. Okay. Let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 1, verse 18. Okay? Take a look at that one for a second. All right? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 18. Last verse. All right? Now, over there, what does he say? He says that, with more knowledge, one has more anger. Okay? So, knowledge, he says in several places, that knowledge is a very wonderful thing. Even though he seems to say in other places, it's not. There's another contradiction. But he says a wonderful thing. So it would seem that anger is a good thing. All right? Then take a look, for instance, at 7:3. Again, he says, anger is better than rejoicing. Okay? It would seem to be that anger is good. Then he says, however, he says in another place, and I'll show it to you in a second, he says that you must remove anger from your heart, because anger is something which resides in the and resides in the bosom of a fool. Okay? That verse, excuse me, hold on one second. Yes, that's okay, I got it. It's 11:10. Pardon me for that. 11:10. He says, remove anger from your heart. He says, and you will be, and remove an evil from your flesh. Because youth is emptiness. Again, that word, hevel. That's the same word. Keeps on recurring. All right? So here you have a contradiction. Over here he says, remove anger from your heart. And he also says, and remove an evil from your flesh. Now, that seems to be a pretty bad thing. On the other hand, over here he says, in 1:18, because with much knowledge is much anger. That seems to be anger is a good thing. And then again, where I showed you before, in chapter 7, he says, 7:3, he says, anger is better than rejoicing. All right? That seems to be, he's promoting it. He thinks it's a good thing. Now, you see a contradiction. Now, throughout Ecclesiastes, there are contradictions. Now, the wise king, a wise person doesn't contradict, an ordinary person that's intelligent doesn't, or at least superficially doesn't contradict themselves, or doesn't try to contradict themselves. Now here we're talking about King Solomon, the wisest of men, and we see the book is laden with contradictions. So as a matter of fact, the Talmud says, and we'll get to this piece of Talmud, interesting piece of Talmud, the Talmud says that they really wanted to take the book of Ecclesiastes out of circulation. They wanted to place it into Geniza. I'll explain to you what that means. It says, why did they want to do that? Because they said his words contradict each other. Contradictory. Okay. I'll explain to you what the buttons. I'll tell you why. We'll take up that piece of Talmud. As usual, the Talmud really gives us the greatest insight and really gets to the core of something. And that statement itself is the fact that they mention the contradictions is very important, because that's at the heart of his book. Now, why are there so many contradictions in the book? The answer is very simple. The reason why he wrote in that manner is because in Jewish philosophy is different. Torah philosophy, I should say, is different than other philosophies. Because other philosophies or other philosophers, their concern is simply to express their ideas. That's the only concern they have. So they try to express their ideas as clearly as possible. But Torah has a problem with that. Because Torah maintains that ideas are very good for a person that's on the level. But a person that's not on the level, ideas can be harmful. And that's why the wise people always wrote in a parable form. You see, in the beginning of Proverbs, to understand the parables and the riddles of the wise. Why in riddles? Because they wish to protect the ignorant from misunderstanding their words. And if you take a look at Ecclesiastes, right at the end, you have the exact same statement. All right, it says that when it speaks about Ecclesiastes, it says that in 12:9, and not only was Ecclesiastes a wise man, he taught the people. And he says in the end of the verse, it says he formulated many parables. Okay, so the parable, and we'll see the parables that are in Ecclesiastes, what exactly it means. But the parable is there because the Torah philosopher is not ready to just give away his knowledge. He's not interested in showing how much he knows. That's an arrogant kind of an ego idea. And the only thing he's interested in doing is conveying Torah to the right people to improve them. So he has to be very cautious. That's why the prophet says also that the words, the lips of the priest guard the knowledge. That means they don't just give it out. You have to know who and when you're giving out the knowledge to. Sometimes it can be very harmful if you give something to someone they're not ready for. That's why the parable, and that's why the Medrash, that's why people today, unfortunately, Medrash was never meant to be written down and wasn't meant to be taught to the masses, just to the scholars. And it's written in parables. And as soon as the masses get a hold of it, they misinterpret it, and they come up with the most inane ideas, which are very harmful. So over here, we have to realize that the methodology, here you have an example of the methodology of the wise king. The methodology was contradiction. Because the average person, when he looks at it, is going to see, oh, it's a contradiction. I don't understand what this is. So he's going to walk away confused. And he's just going to say to himself, well, I guess I don't understand what Ecclesiastes is talking about. And that's not bad. If a person is ignorant, not to understand something is not bad, as long as he knows he doesn't understand it. But on the other hand, an intelligent person will immediately see that, just a moment, what is going on here? He is trying to tell me something. This can't be a real contradiction. This is superficially a contradiction, but there must be an idea here. So for the intelligent person, it's a guiding light to look down beneath the surface. Okay? Let's take this one. I'll just show you how this one works. Ovieri says that with much knowledge, there's much anger. Okay? And then he says later again, he says, remove anger from your heart and you will be removing an evil from your flesh. Okay? Now, what does he mean in those verses? What we have to look at is the generic definition of anger. What does anger mean? There must be one definition of anger. And then there is a subdivision. One anger he's discussing in Ecclesiastes 1. Another anger he's discussing in Ecclesiastes, 9.